Heraclides passed the child over as if it was the most natural thing in the world to hold a baby. I put my hands out by reflex, without a chance to object. I'd never held a baby before in my life. The baby immediately tried to crawl off my lap. I was afraid he'd fall and hit his head on the ground and die. I held on tighter. The baby cried at once. I was suddenly afraid I'd hurt the thing and relaxed my grip. The baby fell off my lap.
Whoa!
I grabbed him as he fell. Diotima laughed at me. Here, Diotima, play with this baby, would you? I dumped the baby in her lap before she could object. Diotima, being a woman, knew exactly what to do with it.
Here, Socrates, she said, passing over the child. Play with this baby, would you?
How come I'm the one left holding the baby? He whined.
Because I'm bigger than you are,
Diotima said coolly.
Then how come Nico dumped it on you?
Because he's bigger than me,
Diotima said, delivering an important lesson in power politics.
He vomited on me,
Socrates said.
Babies do that,
Heraclides said absently as he searched through a leather case full of scrolls.
He'll be all right. Cute, isn't he?
Heraclides pulled out a scroll and began to read.
Ah, yes.
What are you doing? I asked.
I'm just reminding myself about hemlock. I myself don't usually prescribe it. Those who do use it to treat severe pain in the joints and uncontrollable tremors.
He took the vial from my hands and held it close to his eyes.
What makes you think this contains hemlock? He asked.
The smell?
Diotima said.
This vial is of a type used by doctors to contain medicine. It might be a prescribed dose.
Heraclides opened the stopper and took the lightest sniff. He made a face and put back the stopper.
It's hemlock, all right.
He rummaged once more through the scroll jar beside him. He pulled one out and unrolled it.
Ah, yes. The normal dose for medicinal use is one leaf, two at most.
What would be a fatal dose?
Diotima asked.
Six leaves, according to the authorities. I can't say of my own knowledge. A man taking hemlock to kill himself will typically make sure of it by taking much more, 10 or 12 leaves. The roots and berries are more toxic than the leaves.
How long would it take to kill a man? I asked. Heraclides shrugged.
It's highly variable. A man who drank a cup of the potion and then exercised vigorously might die quite quickly, but a large man who lay still could take as much as half a day.
Apollo's light was well to the west. This being the middle of summer, the sun god would remain with us longer. Soon it would be dinner time. This was the evening assigned for the negotiation between our fathers for the marriage between myself and the woman who, as far as I was concerned, was already my wife. I sent Socrates to our tents with orders to make sure everything was ready and to collect wine. I escorted Diotima to her tent to dress for the dowry negotiation. Typically, the prospective bride and groom would go nowhere near such talks, but in the special circumstances, our attendance was required. Diotima entered her tent while I waited outside. I waited a long time.
"Are you all right in there?" I called. "What's keeping you?"
"Everything."
I went in. I found Diotima naked, which was nice, but not quite according to plan. How long does it take to change a chiton?
I can't decide what to wear, she wailed. Should I dress as a modest young woman or a forthright woman of the world?
Diotima, indecisive?
Go with the modest maiden,
I advised, thinking that would most likely please my father.
A bit too late for that, but I'll try for modest, she said nervously.
I was nervous too, more than I'd been in a long while. Whether or not our fathers could agree would affect the rest of our lives. Whatever decision they reached would bind us, and I had no idea what was about to happen. Diotima, on the other hand, had a clear view.
This meeting is all about the state of my genitals, she said as she wrapped about herself an unrevealing chitin of dull browns and reds.
That's true, I admitted.
So why can't I speak for myself?
Because your genitals are the concave sort, I said.
Listen, Diotima, I'm very happy about the state of your genitals. You better be. They're your doing.
You don't regret it, do you? I asked, alarmed at the bitter tone of her voice. She smiled.
No, Nico, I don't. Not at all. I'm sorry if I sound tense, but I'm worried about this meeting between your father and Pythax.
So am I. Poor girl, she was embarrassed about the whole thing. This problem existed because she'd chosen to get into bed with me, with, it must be said, substantial encouragement on my part. And now two old men were about to discuss her sex life. I lifted the tent flap for her to exit. Outside, she said,
Your father doesn't like me.
I nodded. There was no point denying it.
It's not you personally, Diotima. It's so important to him that his grandchildren be citizens. And your family is, unconventional?
She supplied helpfully.
I guess I'm the lucky one.
No, I said.
That's me.
And I took her in my arms and kissed her, just as a woman with two girl children walked past. The woman turned her head and sniffed. The young girls watched closely.
We're in public!
Diotima, the girl with the unconventional family, had the most conventional morals in Athens. To kiss one's wife in public is scandalous behavior. So I dragged her back into the tent.
Nico, Diotima said, startled. What are you doing?
Making sure your genitals are still concave? Diotima squealed. Sorry, cold hands. I escorted Diotima to my father's tent eventually. You're late, he complained. Sorry, father, something came up. Not being a camping or fighting man by inclination, Sophroniscus hadn't his own canvas. He'd hired one from the local scam merchants. It was tattered and smelled of decay, but it kept the sun off our heads and was warm enough at night. By rights, we should have met at the house of the bride's father, or in this case, his tent, but Pythax had refused. I suspect because he was embarrassed. Pythax had come to respectability late in life. Perhaps that was why he held on to it so tightly. He dressed in a formal chitin, dyed in bright reds and greens, that hung all the way to his ankles, and covered a body that would have done credit to a man half his age. He wore sandals on his wide, flat feet, feet that had never before known any protection. A hamadion of the finest Milesian wool draped about his shoulders and trailed down his left arm. It was the dress of a wealthy gentleman, and it must have cost him a small fortune. On a man like Pythax, who had spent his life in leather armor, the effect was faintly ridiculous. Or perhaps that was because I'd known him when he was still a slave. On his head, a circlet of flowers sat askew. Beneath it, his craggy features and scarred, sunburned skin gave lie to the entire pose. Pythax and Father sized each other up, and it was almost comic to see. The large, well-muscled man who looked so totally out of place, and the short, stocky sculptor.
I never thought I'd negotiate a marriage opposite a northern barbarian, my father said.
I winced.
And I never thought I'd be negotiating with an artist weakling,
Pythax growled.
I forced a smile. Can I bring you refreshments, sirs?
They ignored me.
They sat down on either side of a low traveling chest to face each other. The camp stool onto which Pythax lowered his bottom creaked under the strain, but didn't quite splinter. I set out cups and poured wine for them both. The more, the better, I reasoned, and poured only an equal measure of water. For a business meeting, the ration would normally be 3 water to 1 wine. Sophroniscus said,
We are here to negotiate the marriage of my son, Nikolaos, with your stepdaughter, Diotima.
They're already married,
Pythax said.
They are not, said Sophroniscus.
They are, said Pythax. They say they did the ceremony.
Then perhaps we should review what happened.
Sophroniscus turned to me.
Nikolaos, did you perform the rite of marriage with Diotima?
Yes, sir.
It wasn't the answer my father wanted, but it was the truth, and I didn't regret it.
There, you see,
said Pythax.
Sophroniscus persisted.
In this ceremony you say you performed, did the girl hand her girdle to her mother?
No, father, how could she? Diotima's mother wasn't there.
So the girl wasn't prepared by her mother. Did either of you bathe in the morning?
No.
Did you walk from our home to hers to collect her from her father?
No.
Did you place her in a chariot drawn by a horse to lead her to her new home?
Father, everything you ask was impossible.
Precisely, said Sophroniscus. It is impossible that the marriage ceremony could have taken place as it is practiced by the Athenians. Therefore, no marriage has occurred.
Pythax turned a dangerous red.
You're saying my daughter's been used, and now you won't do anything about it.
It would help if we weren't doing everything backward, my father said to me. It's traditional to negotiate the dowry before you bed the girl.
Diotima had sat silently behind Pythax up to this point. Now she sat up straight and angry and said,
That was my choice, thank you very much.
Pythax said angrily,
Sophroniscus, if you try to deny this marriage, I'll sue you.
On what grounds?
Father demanded.
Damage to my property.
Property?
Diotima fairly screeched.
I'm pretty sure those bits are my property.
But Pythax was right. No father in his right mind would contract a non-virgin for his son. After what had happened, if we returned Diotima, she'd only be good as a second wife for older men whose first had died. To calm the situation, I said,
We didn't mean to get married, sirs. It sort of just happened. Sorry.
Don't add lying to your father to your crimes. You're not sorry at all,
father said. He sighed.
Pythax, I'll be honest with you. I'm not against my son marrying your daughter, not necessarily, anyway.
but I insist we negotiate on the basis that nothing has yet happened. There is no fait accompli here, no certainty, and certainly no presumption that the girl has been accepted without a dowry.
All right, Pythax said gruffly. Can't say I agree, but it sounds fair. What do you call a reasonable dowry?
The normal arrangement would be the girl's inheritance from her late father. I've looked into this, and I know she's in line for his house and his farm.
I had to stifle a gasp. Diotima's late father had been comfortably well off, not dirty rich like the aristocrats, but worth far more than my own father. Such a dowry would more than double our family's wealth. It seemed an outrageous demand, and yet father was correct. Tradition clearly required the woman to bring her inheritance with her. Anything less amounted to theft by the stepfather. For the first time I realized this negotiation might not be as simple as I thought. Pythax said,
I can agree to the house in the city, but the farm has to stay with me. The city house will give the young couple a place to live.
Away from my Diotima's new in-laws, Pythax didn't say, but clearly implied. It's the custom that the bride will join the family of her husband in his family home, where she must live in the women's quarters with her mother-in-law. It wasn't the most comfortable arrangement for the bride, who would frequently be bossed and lectured by her mother-in-law, but she would learn the ways of her new family very quickly. The son of a very wealthy man might move out of the family home with his bride. Pericles had done so, but only with the permission of his father. Father shook his head.
That won't work, he said. A city house is a sink for wealth, not a source of it. How could my son maintain such a household?
You could help him,
Pythax said.
I'm not made of money.
Father carefully avoided revealing his financial straits.
The farm must come with the house, or Nico will have no way to maintain his household. I must insist.
Take the city house, Pythax urged. I'll throw in the house slaves.
As he sat thinking, my father glanced over the shoulder of Pythax and caught my eye. I nodded vigorously. Father said,
I'm sorry, Pythax, but I can't agree to this.
It's the best offer you'll get,
Pythax said.
Sophroniscus said, then we have an impasse.
And no marriage. I gripped Diotima's hand out of sight. Diotima could contain herself no longer. She burst out.
Dear gods, I don't care about the farm. Why don't we all just share the bloody thing?
Pythax said,
it's not that big, Diotima. There's enough to feed one family, but not two.
Sophroniscus nodded. It was the only time the two men had agreed on anything.
Such arrangements never work, he said. It always leads to fighting and court cases at harvest time.
Pythax said,
I got nothing against your boy, Sophroniscus, but I gotta say you're overrating him. What would you ask for if you didn't know my girl was an heiress? Nothing like what you're demanding from me, I'll bet. The house on its own is more than you'd get from any other father.
Pythax had a point. An average dowry between two artisan families might run to a year's wages, say 400 or 500 drachma. I had no idea what it cost to buy a house, but it must surely be many times that.
We must acknowledge the obvious fact that the girl's family is not an asset,
Father said. I suppressed a groan. I'd expected Father would raise this, but hoped he wouldn't.
In Athens, a marriage is as much a union of families as a union of two young people. The wife's family is expected to bring to the party prestige and advantage.
You can't say that,
Pythax protested.
The girl's dad was a great statesman.
Forgive me, Pythax. I would not raise the subject except that it's an essential point. But I must point out that the girl's mother was a Hetaera. Pythax controlled his temper most admirably.
Not anymore.
Granted, but it's the family history that people remember. The girl was born illegitimate.
Not any longer. They made her legitimate so she could inherit.
Granted again.
And you're in no position to complain, Sophroniscus. If your boy marries my girl, he'll become the heir.
That's why all the property must come to him. There was no point in going on. The meeting broke on inability to agree about the farm. I knew father's need for money. I knew he couldn't accept less. All Pythax had to do was say yes, and Diotima and I would be married. I was so frustrated I wanted to scream. Why wouldn't Pythax release what was Diotima's? Sophroniscus and Pythax agreed to consider their positions and talk again, back in Athens after the Olympics. I left the tent in a daze. Diotima followed, and I think she suppressed a sob. I held her tight and didn't give a curse what any passing man thought. She said in my ear, "We came so close, Nico. So close." Over Diotima's shoulder, I watched Pythax's back retreat, an angry and insulted man. He stamped down the muddy path that was lined with burning torches, lit so that the Olympic party could continue all night.
"Pythax!"
I called. He stopped and turned. I said to Diotima, "Wait for me here," then ran to Pythax. We stood together in the mud. I said, "Pythax, I'm sorry about what happened in there."
"So am I, little boy,"
he said sadly.
"I'm gonna do the best for my girl. And Diotima wants you. God knows why. There's not much meat on you."
"Thanks a lot, Pythax."
"But look at yourself, lad. You look like you ain't got a muscle in your body."
He grabbed my upper arm and pinched it. I winced.
"You're way too skinny to be my son-in-law. You better put on some meat, or I'll be embarrassed to be seen with you at the gymnasium."
Pythax gloried in the gymnasium as few men did. When he was a slave, it had been forbidden to him. Now, he expressed his citizenship by frequenting the place as often as he could.
"But I gotta be honest, little boy. If your father don't change his mind, it ain't gonna happen."
"My father is unreasonable," I said bitterly. Pythax sighed.
"No, little boy, he ain't. Your dad's doing exactly what he ought to do, and he's got right on his side. Diotima inherited the house and the farm from her dad. She's got every right to take it with her when she marries. I know that."
"Then,
why won't I release it?"
Pythax was shamefaced.
"It's like this, lad. When I was a slave, I didn't need to worry about where I would sleep, or what I would eat, or how I would pay for it, right?"
"Sure."
"Then I became a free man, a citizen. Free men don't get nothing for free. And I got a house now, and a wife."
"Oh." Suddenly I realized what the problem for Pythax must be.
"I don't know how to make money,"
Pythax said.
"Never had to. That farm Diotima inherited from her dad, It's the only income I got.
Diotima's mother had very expensive tastes. She was used to the best, and Pythax was too besotted to deny her.
Don't tell anyone, all right? It'd destroy me if men knew I couldn't support my own family. They'd say it was because I used to be a slave. They'd say I wasn't a real citizen.
I knew what a big admission this was for Pythax. For a man of his pride, for what he'd achieved and how he'd risen, it must have been painful beyond words. I understand, Pythax. Keep the farm. I don't need it.
Yes, you do. Your dad's right about that, too. But I ain't got no choice. I tell you, nobody better get in my way today, or...
Yah! Yor!
Two Heracles imitators in lion skins jumped in front of us and swung their clubs. Pythax grabbed their necks, smashed their heads together, and tossed their unconscious bodies to the side of the path.
Or I might get angry,
he finished, and strode off to the Olympics, a desperately unhappy citizen. The aborted marriage negotiation left me very depressed. It would require godlike powers of persuasion to reconcile everyone's differences. Maybe Pericles could have talked his way through, as he had so many times with the people of Athens, as he had with the judges to get Timo back in the games, but Pericles would never involve himself in our domestic dispute. If only I possessed the honeyed tongue of Pericles. But Pericles had told me when we first met that I had a poor voice. Even the great Pindar only yesterday had derided my speech, and he should know, because he was a professional. Pindar! My rhetoric might be poor, but my investigation skills were top-notch. I tracked Pindar down at an extended late-night dinner party beside the sacred altar, which was already decked out in flowers for the festivities to come the next morning. I knew I could rely on Pindar being wherever the biggest audience was to be found. I said, Pindar, when we last spoke, you said you could teach me tricks of flattery. Did you mean it?
Perhaps.
He sounded evasive in the face of my enthusiasm. I hopped from one foot to the other.
Would you teach me? You see, I have a problem.
I explained the situation with Diotima and my father and Pythax. I didn't explain it well. I came to a confused halt. Pindar buried his chin in his chest and thought.
I see. Affairs of the heart. A family in dispute. Yes, this is the stuff of poetry. It lacks only a 10-year-long war to reach Homeric proportions, or perhaps a murder in the family. I don't suppose you have a close relative that you're willing to sacrifice.
Socrates was a temptation, but... Sorry, I'll have to disappoint you there.
A pity. Nevertheless, that only affects the aesthetics, not the solution, which is simplicity itself.
It is? I blinked. Could the answer to my problems be so easy?
Tell me what to do.
Not you, me. I will write a praise song in your honor.
I laughed.
That's impossible, Pindar. I've done nothing that qualifies for a song.
Praise songs are always in honor of war heroes and sports victors.
Not so. You're a contestant in these Olympics, are you not? I distinctly heard the chief judge take the oath from you. When you catch this killer, then you, Nikolaos, son of Sophroniscus, will be an Olympic victor.
It hit me like a fist. Pindar was right. I could win at the Olympics.
Dear gods, Pindar, you're a genius.
Yes, I know. When your father and prospective father-in-law hear your name sung in praise before the assembled Hellenes, all your difficulties will vanish in their pride of being the father of an Olympic victor, whose song is sung by the greatest poet since Homer, he said modestly.
Didn't you say this morning that you were immune to flattery?
I'm immune to yours. I'm totally vulnerable to my own. I thought about it, then asked,
Can you get in a mention of Diotima?
It's immoral to praise a woman, but I'll try to squeeze in a brief allusion.
Maybe something about Hera, helpmeet to mighty Zeus? He mused. Leave it with me. I'll think of something.
Thanks, Pindar, I said in gratitude. You know, don't you, that a praise song doesn't come cheap?
I knew there'd be a catch. How much? Pindar named a sum. I staggered back in shock.
Dear gods, people pay that?
It's the going rate. Normally my clients are in such euphoria from their victory that they don't stop to think. You're unusual in that you're currently rational.
The taste of reconciling my family was too sweet to refuse. I didn't have the money. I had no idea how to get it, but I'd think of something.
Start writing my song, Pindar. There's one final point.
I sighed.
Yes?
You'll have to catch the killer, Nikolaos.
Well, of course.
I don't think you've quite caught my meaning. You have to catch the killer, not the Spartan. If the Spartan Marcos beats you to it, then he has the victory, and you have no victory song, nor, it would seem, any hope of a marriage.
Day 3 of the 80th Olympiad of the Sacred Games. Homer's rosy fingers clutched the dawn. Timodemus had 2 days to live, 3 if you counted the day on which he'd be tried and executed. At least today I wouldn't have to drag reluctant men away from the sport to question them, because most of day 3 is dedicated to the worship of Zeus. One happy effect of this was that the men could sleep in, whereas the sports began at the crack of dawn, the service could not begin until the main attraction had been driven in from wherever it was kept waiting. I woke in my tent and pulled on my chiton, the only decent clothing I had, and wandered out to blink at the sun and wonder if there was anything to eat. Socrates was already outside, protesting loudly.
I won't wear a chiton, he said.
Yes, you will, our father said. This is a sacred festival, and I won't have you wandering about looking like a small child. You can wash in the river, too.
I'm clean enough,
Socrates grumbled.
Father looked to me, and I knew what to do. I picked up the bucket of water that lay between our tents and threw it on Socrates.
Now you're clean, I said cheerfully.
Socrates sputtered and gave me a look that said he would have, as cheerfully, thrown a bucket of snakes at me. Nevertheless, he was clean, an unusual state for him. I held Socrates down while Father pulled the chiton over him. This was an old cast-off garment of our father's, which had been cut down to size by our mother for Socrates to wear, or rather, almost to size. Mother had allowed room for my little brother to grow. The sleeves ended somewhere slightly past his fingers,
and the bottom edge trailed along the ground. Socrates almost tripped over it when he took a step. Father hitched up the chitin, tied a belt rope around Socrates' waist to hold up the extra material, and cheerily declared we were ready to go. We joined the crowd, streaming to the sanctuary of Zeus, where we met up with Diotima, as we'd arranged. Women might not be allowed in the stadium when the games were on, but these were religious rites, and the sanctuary was open to everyone. I saw Marcos with the other Spartans, though he stood somewhat apart. I guessed he was unpopular with his fellows since the fight with Scarathos. I beckoned, and he came to join us. A vast cloud of dust hung in the air above the road from Elis. If I hadn't known better, I might have called it smoke from a forest fire, or perhaps the coming of the gods. But I knew what to expect, and so I stood, Diotima and Socrates beside me, and we stared. From the base of the cloud emerged a large, plodding ox, and alongside it walked a man. Both were difficult to make out. The ox's coat was white against the gray of the road dust hanging in the air. Another ox and man emerged behind the first, and another, until 100 oxen were visible on the road. The procession was so long that by the time the last appeared out of the dust raised by their hooves, the first ox had entered Olympia. Each ox was garlanded in bright ribbons and crowned with an olive wreath, but there was something more spectacular than the colorful adornments. Socrates gaped.
"Is that real?" he asked.
"It is," said Diotima. "Each ox to be sacrificed today has a coat of pure white."
"I thought it was road dust,"
Socrates said.
"No, they breed them like this."
"How?"
Diotima shrugged.
"Don't ask me."
"They allow only the bulls with white coats to mate," said a man beside us in the press. "If a calf is born with an absolutely perfect coat of white, then it's made an ox and reserved for sacrifice."
"It's incredible,"
Socrates said, and for once I had to agree with him. This was one of the most amazing sights in all of Hellas. 100 pure white oxen, garlanded in flowers and with bright ribbons about their horns. Each ox was led through the entrance into the sanctuary, where the grand altar of Zeus was ready and waiting. The Hellenes were about to make their greatest sacrifice to Zeus, for these 100 white oxen, especially bred for their fate, were on their way to the god. The first of the oxen was led by his keeper to the altar, where waited the butcher of the games with the tools of his trade. The crowd walked along with the first of the sacrifices. Men called out good luck to the ox, and wished it well, and thanked the beast for consenting to be sacrificed. Those who could reached out to pat it gently. The priest of Zeus spoke to the beast. I couldn't hear what he said, but he seemed happy with the result because he stood back and the butcher stepped forward. He was a huge man with bulging triceps that would have compared favorably with Pythax's or even Arachos's. The butcher swung a large mallet and struck the ox direct on the forehead. The stunned animal stood stock still, but lowered its head as if to nod in agreement. The crowd sighed in happiness. The butcher dropped the mallet and picked up a large, very sharp knife. This he thrust into the beast's neck and sliced to cut its throat. The blood spurted at a tremendous rate. Priests who stood waiting with large bowls hurried to catch the sacrifice's lifeblood. As each bowl filled, another took its place, until slowly, but with tremendous grace, the animal's legs gave way and it sank to the ground.
"It was a fine sacrifice," Sophroniscus said.
Diotima pulled me aside.
Nico, did you see that? A mallet to the head would be just the thing to stun Arikos.
Before they beat him to death, you mean?
Yes. I've seen lots of sacrifices. I've performed plenty of them myself, but it's never quite... struck me the same way.
What about your idea that he was disabled by hemlock?
This is the same, but with solids.
The priests and attendants stood back, and what seemed like 100 slaves stepped forward. The ox had been led up onto a wooden platform, the underside of which dripped with grease of pig fat to make it slippery. An Aulos player put his V-shaped recorder to his lips and began to play sacred music. The slaves took up ropes and began to heave in time to the music. The remains of the sacrifice slowly but surely glided along the path, thanks to the slippery fat, to the waiting barbecue pits. The butcher of the games and his attendants would spend the rest of the day dismembering the sacrifices to prepare them for the feast tonight. The Feast of the Oxen is one of the most popular for one simple reason. At no other time in the next 4 years would we have a chance to eat so much meat of such high quality. There were poor men present who might not even see such meat again until the next Olympics. The butcher was already spattered with blood, which made for an interesting effect on his formal chitin. Large drops of grease had fallen from the passing sled and formed small pools of slipperiness in the muddy ground. I wondered if anyone would step in it. That put me in mind of Socrates and his clean tunic. I said, "Socrates, look out for the slippery patches, and for Father's sake, try to keep your chitin clean, all right?" No answer. I'd expected a sarcastic comment. "Socrates?" I looked about me. He wasn't there. I said, "Diotima, weren't you keeping an eye on Socrates?" "No," she said shortly. "He's my brother-in-law, not my child." I said, "Has anyone seen Socrates?" No one had. Socrates had disappeared. He was probably safe. Any normal boy would spend the day running between the grown-ups, playing in the crowd, stealing extra meat from the barbecue, and then make his way back to camp that night for his scolding. The only problem was, that was what any normal boy would do. Socrates, on the other hand, was fully capable of climbing into the barbecue pits to see how they worked. Father remained admirably calm. He said only two words. "Find him." We spread out. I reasoned that he couldn't have gotten far, not because Socrates couldn't move fast, but because the press of people made it impossible. The same press made it difficult for me to move, too. I became overly acquainted with the sweaty armpits and backs of the men and women I brushed past. It was Marcos who found my errant brother.
"He's over here!"
Jumping up onto the plinth of a statue, I saw Marcos standing near the fire pits, which reignited my fear that Socrates had fallen into one. Marcos waved and shouted. Somehow, over the chaos, I managed to hear him. Diotima heard, too, and she was closer. She pushed her way through to Marcos before me. Slaves were already at work on the pits. They'd kindled 100 fires. Wood chips had been added, and the smoke smelled sweet. When the fires burned strong, the slaves would add stones to glow red-hot and be the base on which the oxen would roast. Other slaves prepared the wooden frames to hold the carcasses. Tonight, the Hellenes would enjoy the largest barbecue in the world. Then I saw what had attracted the attention of my over-inquisitive little brother. Socrates sat on a stone in earnest conversation with a man who wore a large flowing robe of the deepest purple. Tall and thin,
with a nose long enough to double as a spear. Upon the man's feet were sandals that were quite obviously made of bronze. How he walked in them, I don't know, but they glared in the sun so that you couldn't miss the odd footwear. Beside the strangely dressed man was a fire pit, much smaller than the 100 official pits. The small pit looked quite forlorn. A shovel and heaped dirt lay discarded beside it. The stranger leaned over a pile, almost as tall as me, of gray, squishy bread dough. He kneaded the dough, handful by handful, as he conversed with Socrates. In fact, I saw he'd handed some dough to Socrates, who was also kneading. Already the two of them had attracted a small crowd. Socrates looked up and said without apology for wandering off,
"Oh, hello, Nico. This man is making an ox."
"You mean he's cooking an ox?" I corrected.
"No, he's making one, out of bread."
I said to the man, "Can I ask a question?" He nodded as he kneaded the dough on his lap.
"That's why I'm here. I was once a fish, you know."
It wasn't entirely the answer I'd expected. "You don't say."
"And a bird."
Light dawned. Yes, this was exactly the sort of person Socrates would take up with. I said, "You're not a philosopher by any chance, are you?"
"My name is Empedocles, son of Meton, and I am indeed a lover of knowledge. How did you guess?"
"Just a feeling I had. Why are you making an ox out of bread?" He clapped his hands in happiness, and bits of dough splattered over us.
"That's the question I hope many will ask. The answer is because it's immoral and unethical to consume meat. My plan is simple, yet brilliant,"
he elucidated.
"Tonight I will hand out pieces of my bread ox. Then everyone will see we can all eat bread instead of meat, and there's no need to kill our fellow creatures."
Socrates asked,
"But why did you say you'd been a fish and a bird? Did the gods transform you, sir?"
"What happens when you die?"
Empedocles asked Socrates in return. Socrates looked confused. Everyone knew the answer to that.
My psyche goes down to Hades?"
"Not so," Empedocles said. "The psyches of the dead are reborn in other living creatures. We've all lived past lives."
If we had, this was the first I'd heard of it. I could tell from the expressions of Diotima, Marcos, and Socrates that they, too, had never heard of such a thing. Empedocles continued.
"In my own past lives, for example, I've been both a fish and a bird. When we hold a beast in our hands, it could be our own son, our mother, our daughter from a previous life. When we consume the flesh of the sacrifice, young boy, it's nothing less than cannibalism."
"Yuck!"
Socrates said. Empedocles said this not only to us, but to the rapidly growing crowd that had come to watch. Empedocles worked as he talked, trying to mold the bread dough and failing miserably. After a while of watching him struggle with the dough, Socrates remarked rather rudely,
"It doesn't look much like an ox."
"Anyone can be a critic," Empedocles said to him. "Can you do better?"
"Sure I can," Socrates said. "Nico and I are the sons of a sculptor."
Empedocles blinked.
"You are? Good. Then you can both help me."
And before I could object, he handed us trowels and a set of sculpting tools so new they shone in the sun. I couldn't see any harm in it. Socrates was interested in talking to Empedocles, and I was simply relieved that we hadn't found my brother grilled with the oxen. Together we wrestled the dough into something that approximated a bovine body. Everything sagged. Diotima and Marcos laughed at our efforts. That made me determined to do the job right. After a time I stood, tossed the tools on the ground, and announced,
"There!"
Empedocles looked thoughtfully at my creation, rubbed his chin, and said,
"It looks more like a cow, doesn't it?"
"It's definitely an ox."
I turned to Diotima and Marcos.
"It looks like an ox, doesn't it?"
I said. They both nodded gravely.
"Definitely an ox," Marcos said. "I see it clearly."
As we worked, Socrates questioned Empedocles closely on the doctrine of reincarnation, as he called it. Empedocles was puzzled that a mere child should show an interest, so I explained proudly that Socrates had once met the philosopher Anaxagoras, who told us everything was made of infinitesimal particles, and Empedocles almost exploded.
"That mountebank!" he shouted. "I know this fellow you talk of, and let me assure you he's no more a philosopher than this boy here."
He gestured at Socrates.
"Tell me, have you ever seen these supposed particles?"
"Well, no," I admitted.
"Have you touched one?"
"No."
"Heard one?"
"No."
"And nor will you, because they don't exist."
Empedocles snorted.
"The whole idea is simply bad philosophy. I've solved the riddle of matter, and it has nothing to do with these ridiculous particles."
"Then what is it, sir?"
Socrates asked eagerly, because he was always desperate to learn from philosophers.
"All matter is composed from earth, air, fire, and water. They combine in different portions to form everything around us."
Socrates thought about it, his head cocked on one side, then he asked,
"But, sir, what moves the earth, fire, air, and water to combine in different portions?"
"That's simple. Love and strife. Love and strife, young boy, are what move everything in the universe."
Love and strife move everything. Empedocles might be crazy, but he'd given me an idea.
"Nikolaos!"
It was an old woman's voice. I turned to see Gorgo with two men at her back, both twice her height. She, too, had come to see the spectacle of the oxen.
"Where's your woman?"
Gorgo asked. I pointed to where Diotima and Marcos stood together. Gorgo motioned, and we all stepped away from Empedocles, who had begun to harangue the amused crowd.
"Why were you making a bread cow?"
Gorgo asked, obviously intrigued.
"It's an ox."
"Looks more like a cow to me. But that's not important now. I have information for you."
She looked about, realized we were in the middle of a crowd that had come to watch Empedocles' strange protest against meat, and signaled for us to follow. Gorgo's two Spartan guards cleared a path for their queen. Gorgo led us, at her slow walk, to a place behind some statues of former Olympic victors. Here there were only a handful of men quietly taking turns to drink from a wineskin. The guards made these drunks feel unwelcome, and they departed with rude gestures and empty threats. When they were gone, Gorgo said,
"I've done some checking of my own, as I told you I would. You're still interested in the cryptea?"
"Yes."
"Then you'll wish to know there are definitely cryptea at Olympia."
"Who?" I asked, excited.
I have no names. I begged a favor of a member of the Gerousia, that's our council of elders, from a fine man who once served with my husband. He's of a conservative disposition himself, and in with the current efforts. He tells me that Zanaris said to him, when they were both well in wine, that he, Zanaris, that is, wants to promote a war against Athens while he's here at Olympia, and that a member of the Cryptea is assisting him. I'm told Zanaris appeared quite confident of success.
That didn't bode well for Athens.
The difficulty is, I don't know what this plan is, or in what capacity the Cryptea might play a part. Olympia, as the location suggests, involves other city-states. The agent may simply be a go-between among allies.
Thank you, Gorgo,
Diotima said.
I've also looked closely into the life of Arachos. I searched for any motive someone who knew him might have had to kill him. I find that Arachos was an exemplary Spartan.
I said, tell me, how many Cryptea are there in total, Gorgo?
The exact number is unknown, of course, but it's possible to deduce. There are 8,000 serving Spartans.
So few! I'd always thought of the Spartans as being a large army, but this was less than half what Athens could put into the field.
You forget that any one Spartan is worth 10 men from any other city. The test of the Cryptea is reserved for those who might one day become leaders in combat. Perhaps one young man in 10 is selected for the test. Of those, perhaps only 1 in 100 shows such resourcefulness and expertise at silent killing that he's selected by the Ephors. From this we may guess the entire membership of the Cryptea is probably not more than 10.
Do you mean to say we're worried about only 10 men?
We're probably only concerned with 1 of those 10, and we're right to be worried. It would require a man of extraordinary talent to face down one of these hidden killers and survive. My Leonidas could have done it. I know of no other man who would stand a chance.
Her eyes glistened as she spoke of her husband, and I realized with a shock that Gorgo was close to crying.
Is there nothing that betrays them?
Diotima asked quickly. She wanted to spare the Queen of Sparta the indignity of tears before strangers.
They live ordinary lives,
Gorgo said.
They're only called upon to provide their special service when the need arises. The only thing that marks them is they must all be of the officer class. I speculate that the Cryptea deliberately restrain their abilities in day-to-day life, so as not to be too obvious.
Terrific, I said glumly.
We'll never spot him. If he even exists, that is. There are at least 2 other ways to interpret the word secrets in that anonymous note.
Gorgo said,
your next step is clear. You must speak with Zanaris. Only he can tell you more.
Will he agree to see us?
He will, because I'll order it personally. For all his faults, Zanaris is a good Spartan, and there's one thing you can rely on from any good Spartan. Marcos, what's the first lesson of our people?
Marcos smiled. To follow orders, Queen Gorgo. Gorgo returned his smile.
It makes life so much simpler.
Following orders might make a man's life simpler, but it certainly didn't make him happier.
There are no cryptea at Olympia, Zanari said, or rather, snarled.